This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. In August of 1798, Napoleon Bonaparte, then an upstart general in the French military, at the time, not somebody who was very well known, was in the ancient city of Qahira, Cairo. And amazingly, he was getting ready. He was dressing up with the help of a senior Sheikh of Al-Azhar by the name of Sheikh Al-Bakri. And he was wearing the garment of the ulama. In fact, he even donned a turban. And with the help of the Sheikh, he then made his way to a very, very well-attended procession on the 12th of Rabi'ul Awwal, in the year 1213 after the Hijrah. And of course, this was a Mawlid celebration that Napoleon himself had sponsored with his own money. And at the end of the ceremonies, while he was sitting with the Azhari Sheikh and with hundreds of people in the audience, according to one later report, he declared that he was a defender of the faith. And he praised the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, and he apparently declared the Shahada and formally embraced Islam. The crowd went wild with shouts of joy and takbir, and this grand Sheikh of Al-Azhar gave him the title as Sultan al-Kabir, and the people bestowed upon him the name Ali. So how exactly did a Corsican-born, short-statured French general by the name of Napoleon become a Sultan al-Kabir Ali Bonaparte? And how would this particular incident change the entire course of history? Well, that is what today's library chat, inshallah ta'ala, will introduce you to, because this incident, Napoleon's invasion of Egypt, is one of the most significant episodes in our entire 14 and a half centuries of Islamic history. And it is the one incident that pushes the Muslim world into modernity and onto the global scene. And please stick with me, because there are some aspects of this Napoleonic story that are exaggerations, and we will get to that. By the way, if you're wondering why I'm dressed like this, or the camera angles or whatnot, so we are just in the middle of the worst winter Arctic storm that Texas has ever faced. We've just gone through three days of not having electricity, or intermittent bouts of electricity. So alhamdulillah, electricity is up and running, or at least I hope it is, inshallah ta'ala. But it is still very, very cold. So I'm dressed up like this. As well, by the way, I purchased a new camera and lens and lighting. And so please tell me, and jazakallah khair to the brothers who online helped me set this up. This is all being set up by myself, but the brothers, you know who you are, you helped me set it up online. So any comments or any feedback, please leave them, inshallah ta'ala, at the bottom. Now let's get back to our story. And let's begin with the French Revolution of 1789. And again, by the way, this entire, you know, library chat, it's a very condensed, chat that really could be discussed in many different episodes. It's very multifaceted. But the point is that, again, the purpose is just to introduce you. It's a very basic overview. It's a bird's eye view of this very interesting episode of Napoleon's invasion of Egypt. Now, let's begin with 1789 and the famous French Revolution. Of course, the French Revolution changes the course of history. It's the first time that the nation state, or the will of the French people, basically supersedes that of a royal family. So now we're getting the beginnings of the modern world, both in America and in France, where the people are sovereign and not the king. And within a decade of the establishment of the French Republic, in May 1798, the French Parliament authorizes a army invasion of Egypt. More than 20,000 troops are authorized to take their naval forces. Napoleon Bonaparte is put in charge of this. However, the troops are not told where they're going. They're simply told it's a surprise mission. And in the spirit of the Enlightenment, very, very interestingly, along with 20,000 people to kill and rape and plunder, 150 scientists are sent with equipment and with, you know, anthropologists, historians, linguists. They're sent to theologians as well, to chronicle and to record and to study the peoples and the civilizations of Egypt. So why is France wanting to invade Egypt in 1798? And realize that 1798, you know, there is no direct colonization yet of the Muslim world. True, England has its hands very deep inside India, but the British Raj has yet to be established, right? You still have the East Indian Trading Company. So they're trading, they have an alliance, and they have an understanding with the Mughal Emperor. So why are the French interested in invading Egypt? Well, there are a number of motivations. First and foremost, primarily to have the upper hand over the British and to threaten the British Empire in India. They felt that by invading Egypt, they might be able to block British trade routes to India. Also, there are theories that because of the slave trade being abolished and banned, the French decided to replace the income from slave trades via colonization. Also, one of the explicit goals of France was to weaken the Ottoman Empire. Bonaparte mentions this explicitly, France wanted a share of the pie, and of course, Egypt is under Ottoman rule. We're going to get there. Of course, the Mamluks were in charge, the governors, but obviously, indirectly, it was under Ottoman rule. As well, there was a personal motivation for Napoleon as well. He felt that this was establishing his own credentials. Napoleon was definitely very, very ambitious. He was aiming to be a very significant player in global history, and he felt that this expedition would jumpstart that route, which of course, by the way, it did. There's also theories that the French establishment was getting irritated of Napoleon, and there was this notion of sending him on a wild goose chase as well, which is, you know, it has its pros and cons, that theory, because you wouldn't send 20,000 troops on a wild goose chase. But there are theories that some of Napoleon's, you know, enemies or whatnot, they wanted to just send him away for the time being. They didn't realize that in returning, he would actually be even more powerful than when they sent him away. And of course, there was also the romantic understanding of Egypt and the pharaonic lands and Moses and the Israelites. So Egypt has captured the imagination of peoples for time immemorial. Now, France, of course, was well aware that Egypt was under the rule of the Mamluks. Now, the Mamluks were as famously known, the slave dynasty, right? The Mamluks, of course, had been there since the time of Salah ad-Din al-Ayyubi, since the time of the Ayyubids, right? So we're literally talking about, you know, more than 500-600 years. And the Mamluks had defeated the Mongols. The Mamluks had defeated so many different enemies that were attacking the lands. And of course, the Mamluks, ethnically, originally, they were primarily from the region known as Circassia, which is basically bordering Russia. And also, there were elements of the Turkish elite as well. And the Mamluks were the actual governors and rulers of Egypt, but they were paying their tithes or their taxes to the Ottomans. And there was a love-hate relationship. There was an awkward relationship between the Mamluks of Egypt and between the Ottomans based in Istanbul. And of course, the Mamluk vassal state wanted its own independence. At times, they didn't pay the taxes. At times, they did. And so you have the local Mamluk ruling elite, who are, generally speaking, you know, obviously, they're intermingling with the people, but they're still a different category, they're a different class. And then you have the actual Ottomans, the Turks, and you have the Turkish emissaries. You have the actual Turks living in Egypt as well. And then, of course, you have the local Egyptian population with groups of ulama, the elites, the merchants, the nobility, the peasants, all different classes of society. That's in a nutshell, so we understand what is going on. Do keep in mind as well, by the way, that Egypt at this point in time was one of the most neglected of all of the Ottoman provinces. And so you couldn't compare Egypt to any of the mainstream Ottoman lands. In fact, we have eyewitness accounts of Napoleon's soldiers and generals when they were chronicling their journey into Egypt and their interactions with the people, that they are appalled at the poverty of the people of Egypt. Overall, the extremely emaciated bodies, the nakedness of even adult women and men, especially amongst the peasant class, there was nothing to cover themselves except maybe the awra. People, you know, very hungry, dying of starvation. One chronicler says there were more dogs in the city of Cairo than people. Obviously, that's an exaggeration. But the point being that, realize that Egypt was not the way we understand it in terms of being one of the capitals of Arabic and Muslim culture. It's going to change, and Napoleon's invasion is the beginning of that change. Now, what are the sources of our talk or about this era, well, there's lots of information that's available. Napoleon's diaries and Napoleon's observations are well known and published about his whole life. Of course, he wrote about his own life in a lot of detail. We also have many of the French elite and the noblemen writing, and we have their writings preserved and translated. We also have perhaps the last of the great Muslim historians, Abdurrahman al-Jabarti, who was an eyewitness. He was actually alive during the invasion, and he was an eyewitness to some of these key incidents. And of course, the invasion has been chronicled by many different historians. I personally would like to recommend two books to all of you that are, I think, are very useful introductory books, even though, of course, much has been written. The first of these is this one here. It is called Napoleon's Egypt. It is written by Juan Cole, Napoleon's Egypt, Invading the Middle East. This is probably one of the better and the more easier books to understand. It's a very nice introduction. And then the second is a translation of Al-Jabarti. This is a little bit more difficult to read because Al-Jabarti has a way of, just like the ancient historians, you know, how they used to write with lots of details. But Al-Jabarti's chronicles have been translated, and you can find this online, both of these books. There's, of course, many other books as well. You can just do a Google search and you find like tons of articles and many other books written about Napoleon's invasion of Egypt and the repercussions of that. Now, again, the goal of our library chat is literally a bird's eye view. And more important than the incidents are what we can derive from them. Now, to briefly summarize the debacle of the invasion, when the French forces sailed, the British, with their spies and their networks, were fully aware of what's going on. And so the British knew that the French were going to invade Egypt, but they didn't know where they would land, and they didn't know the exact dates. There are no spy satellites. It's 1798. And so the British and the French, of course, are the rivals. The British send an envoy to the Mamluks, and the British just literally land in Egypt, get an appointment with the Mamluk emissary of Alexandria, which is the port city, and they tell him, hey, the French are going to invade. Now, the Mamluks are completely oblivious, and they thought that the British are just, you know, going crazy, have no clue what's going on, and the Mamluks told them to get lost, and they did not take that threat seriously. And therefore, on the 1st of July, 1798, the 1st of July, 1798, it's interesting, by the way, that America's been founded. We have the founding fathers going on over here. In 1798, the Najdis are, you know, active in Arabia. They're attacking Mecca, trying to get to conquer Mecca. And in 1798, Napoleon is in Egypt. So really interesting global affairs, you know, going on simultaneously. In 1798, the 1st of July, Napoleon's forces land outside the ancient and the historic city of Alexandria, one of the most historic cities of the world. And Alexandria was taken by a complete surprise. To say that, you know, the Mamluks were not expecting an invasion is an understatement. It's literally Napoleon, as if out of nowhere, brings his 20,000 troops, and within a few hours, he conquers the entire city. There was a feeble attempt by the local, you know, the Mamluk guards, the Mamluk, you know, army of Alexandria. But you see, what we're going to see throughout this entire invasion is the disparity of civilizations, is the technological gap that existed between the French and between the Mamluks. You literally had, no exaggeration, on the one side, you had rifles and you had cannons and you had weaponry, and on the other side, you had scimitars, you had knives and swords, and yes, you did have some, you know, old, you know, guns. I mean, you know, those long guns that are 1700s, early 1700s. Napoleon's, of course, is, we're talking about rifles. The Mamluks, generally speaking, did not have the weaponry. Not every soldier was armed with an actual firearm. Many of their soldiers were still using the weapons of the past. So you had the Mamluks fighting the French, you know, in their regalia with their weaponry. How do you think that battle is going to last? So literally within a few hours, a foreign nation, the French, they come in, they literally just waltz in and they attack one of the most ancient and magnificent cities in the world, and power is transferred from the Mamluks to the French. Bonaparte, by the way, was very clear to his troops. He wanted to make sure that the people were not mistreated to the best way possible. He actually made an announcement among his troops And he proclaimed, and we have these announcements recorded, meaning written down. He proclaimed, and I quote, "The people that we're going to are the Mohammedans. Their first article of faith is there is no God but God, and Muhammad is his prophet. Do not contradict them. Show respect for their muftis and their imams. Show respect for their ceremonies prescribed by the Quran, and show respect for their mosques, etc., etc." So he wanted to make sure that the that his troops did not overtly act sacrilegious. And do remember that Napoleon and his army are now, they're the embodiment of the Enlightenment era. Generally speaking, you can call this like the first secular army. Napoleon's invasion was the most significant interaction with Europe since the Crusades. Remember this point, right? So since the Crusades, the Muslim world has not interacted with Europe in a military manner to the extent that it is now going to undertake. And Napoleon is not coming as a Christian. He's not coming as a Catholic. Napoleon is coming very much as a secular person, where religion is something private. Religion, generally speaking, his troops are not overtly religious. And they had abandoned, many of them, most of them have abandoned Catholicism. Napoleon in particular was very much a deist. He believed in a God, but not necessarily the God of Christianity. And Napoleon issued a proclamation that all weapons should be handed over, and if they are, then everybody would be safe. He told the people of Alexandria that imams and scholars are not going to be harmed. They should continue their prayers uninterrupted, the five daily salawat. And he said that he does not want to interfere in the lives of the Arabs, but they cannot side with the Mamluks or the Ottomans. And he wanted to eliminate the Turkish rule and eliminate the Mamluk ruling over the Egyptians. And Napoleon had brought with him from France an Arabic-based printing press, a printing press with Arabic typesetting. And he used that printing press to start printing propaganda in his favor and distributing it to the townsfolk and the Egyptians. Now, some of you might have listened to my other talk that I gave many years ago about the printing press. Do realize the Muslim world did not have a functional printing press up until this point in time. And it is truly surreal to point out that the first Arabic printing press that was used in the Muslim world was manufactured in Europe, literally brought on the ships of Napoleon by an invading army and used for political propaganda. The symbolism of all of this is just too profound. You know, the metaphors that one can extract from this one incident are very, very deep. So think about that, right? The first printing press that was used on Arabian soil, on Arab soil in Muslim lands, was manufactured in Europe. And it was literally brought by an invading army and thrust on the people, and then used for the first thing printed was political propaganda. And we still have the initial, you know, printing of the proclamation. I think I can put on the screen over here. And the translation reads, I mean, obviously it's much longer than this, but what one paragraph reads, that it begins, "In the name of God, the Rahman, the Rahim, there is no God but Allah. He has no son, and he shares his power with no one. The commander-in-chief of the French armies, Napoleon, General Napoleon Bonaparte, says to the people of Egypt, 'For too long, this bunch of slaves brought in Georgia and the Caucasus,'" meaning the Mamluks, "'has tyrannized the most beautiful country in the world. In the eyes of God, all men are equal. So what entitles the Mamluks to all that makes life comfortable and pleasant? Who owns all of the great estates? The Mamluks. Who have the loveliest slaves? The Mamluks. Who have the most splendid horses and the finest houses? The Mamluks. If Egypt truly and rightfully belongs to them, let them produce the deeds by which God gave it to them. Once you had great cities, large canals, and prosperous trade. What has destroyed all of this, if not the greed, iniquity, and tyranny of the Mamluks?" End quote, and it goes on and on. So we find over here that Napoleon is appealing to their love of this dunya, telling them that all of the problems of the world are because of the Mamluks. And again, I'm not defending the Mamluks. I mean, definitely a lot can be said for any government and any leadership, especially the Mamluks of the time, and even the Ottomans. Again, all of this is part of history that we need to see. So Napoleon is basically using the standard age-old a tactic of divide and conquer, exacerbate ethnic tensions, you know, bring in enticement of this world, bring in racism. You know, those are the Mamluks, the Circassians, the Georgian slaves. Who are they to rule over you? And then, of course, Napoleon is appealing to Islamic sentiment in the name of God, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, etc., etc. And realize that the notion of European invasions was unknown up until this point in time. And of course, the Egyptians had heard of the French, but they didn't understand Napoleon's reasons for invasion. They didn't understand why this group would be coming in. And they most definitely did not understand the Enlightenment era, zeitgeist of the time, if you like, you know, the theology and the politics of Napoleon. So Napoleon is trying his best to convey that I'm not a Catholic. I'm actually pro-Islam. I'm more closer to Islam than I am to Catholicism. And maybe in some ways, you know, one could see where he is coming from. It's interesting that our guy, Abdurrahman al-Jabarti, you know, the famous chronicler, he tries to explain to his Egyptian readers who these invaders are, because again, they've never seen these types of people. And so al-Jabarti writes that they aren't quite Christian, but they're most certainly not Muslim. And he mentions that they lack all types of haya and all types of common sense. Their women don't veil. They fornicate at will, he says. He says the men defecate anywhere they want. They'll just urinate in the streets or defecate anywhere. And then he says, and when they're done, they don't even wipe themselves. This is al-Jabarti writing about this. And then he also quotes Napoleon's proclamation, and he quotes it bit by bit, and he does a bit of a sharh of it, mocking it. It's a very ingenious way of mocking it, pointing, it's like a line by line commentary, you know, pointing out, you know, errors, or maybe he meant this, or it's very worthy of reading if you understand Egyptian humor, but that's in the original Arabic. And it's interesting to note, by the way, that, you know, as al-Jabarti is describing his antagonism towards the French, and they're backward and they smell and they don't dress properly and they defecate in this manner and their women are lacking haya. You know, when you look at the French descriptions of the Egyptians, subhanAllah, you find similar types of sentiments, right? Backwardness and hatred and the same notions of women lacking haya. It's really interesting. Both civilizations are accusing the other of their women lacking haya. And it's just a very anthropological, you know, point here that a lot of times one reads in one's own weaknesses into the other. This is well-known issue in anthropology. Anyway, back to our story. Of course, we talked about Napoleon's capture of Alexandria, but like, Alexandria was a small port city. You really need to capture Qahira, Egypt, Cairo. And once you've done that, then of course, you know, the rest of the country will open up for you. And so Napoleon realized that, of course, he has to march on to Cairo. And the locals of Alexandria had already alerted the people of Cairo that Napoleon is invading. And so for the next few days or weeks, Cairo comes under a panic mode. The Mamluk base is, of course, in Cairo. That's where the majority of the army is. And so for the next, you know, 10-15 days, Dua al-Qunut was done. You know, Salah, special prayers were done. All of the prayers had constant salawat of the Prophet Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam, Adhan. Al-Azhar University started having Qunut every single day. All of the madrasas, the children's schools and whatnot, they began having, you know, special prayers. And the city became very much on red alert. So unlike Alexandria, Cairo was prepared. And Cairo knew there was going to be a showdown. Now the French left Alexandria. There was a small contingent left. So the bulk of the French troops, they started marching on towards Cairo. And of course, there is no way to march other than on foot, okay? Napoleon came on ships. And now, from Alexandria, they have to march on foot in the month of July, okay? Think about that. And the French were wearing their ridiculous costumes head to toe. This is not the era of modern warfare where people wear camouflage and they know what to expect. This is 1798 here. And the French have their plumes and everything, you know, top to bottom. And of course, you know, leave it to invading armies to not really, especially the French, to not really think about the logistical details. Napoleon had forgotten to give his troops adequate water canisters as they marched in the heat of the summer of July in the deserts of Egypt, you know, from Alexandria to Cairo. And they started marching and they don't have adequate water canisters. What do you think is going to happen when the temperatures reach literally in the 120s, 130s Celsius? What is going to happen? Behold, tens and thousands of troops are marching and water, of course, runs out. People started going mad. Many people died. Many of them actually committed suicide. Every time they came across a village, by the time the end troops came, the water had already been finished from the entire village. Stampedes were caused at wells as they're marching through by the French soldiers killing one another for water. And by the time they get to, by the way, of course, mirages as well. For the first time, the French soldiers see mirages everywhere and they think they're going mad. They start running. They think they see water. And of course, it turns out to be a mirage. So because of that, a number of French soldiers even committed suicide. They thought they're going crazy when they see water and there's no water. Eventually, they reached the River Nile and the entire army, it is said, just went berserk and crazy, rushed into the water like madmen. And hey, who wouldn't do that? It started drinking and gulping and whatnot. And of course, you're not supposed to drink water to your fill after you've been dehydrated for a week or two. It took them more than 2 weeks, okay, to march. More than 2 weeks from Alexandria to Cairo. Many of them died. And by the time they got there, they're just gulping up this water, which of course is going to make them sick, dysentery and whatnot. In any case, after a few days of recovery, on the 21st of July, 1798, this is the key battle. And it's called the Battle of the Pyramids that took place because obviously the famous pyramids of Giza were in the background. The famous pyramids that we've all visited or those that have been to Cairo visited. So the French soldiers could see the tips, not the full. Because remember, the Muslim civilizations by and large had ignored the pharaonic. They thought them to be, why would anybody be interested in those, you know, pharaonic monuments? So the three pyramids of Giza and even the Sphinx, was most of them were covered up with sand. Nobody would really care about them. You could see the tips of the pyramids. And so you could see the tips of the pyramids with Napoleon on one side with his roughly 20,000 minus Allah knows how many hundreds or thousands died on the one side, and you have on the other side the Mamluk army here, okay? And this is not a few thousand like Alexandria. No, you have thousands and thousands. I don't know exactly how many, but probably to the tune of more than 10,000 Mamluk soldiers were in Cairo at the time. Still though, you're talking about a trained French battalion. Despite the fact that they're tired, disheveled, thirsty, many of them are sick, still though, they have weapons and they have rifles and they have cannons. Now, the Mamluks did have a very, very rudimentary cannon system, but nothing like the French, right? Most of the Mamluk army didn't have, as we said, weapons. They had ancient muskets going back to the 16th century or whatnot. You can't compare them to the long distance rifles of the French. And there are vivid descriptions, multiple eyewitnesses of this particular battle, the Battle of the Pyramids, where the Mamluks charged en masse. Thousands and thousands of people were charging on their horses. And Napoleon had his troops lined up. And there's actually, you know, modern movies that have been done by the French and others to depict this battle. You can see this online. And Napoleon used the standard tactic. Again, we've seen this in the movies all the time, but the Mamluks hadn't seen the movies. The Mamluks didn't know what to do, right? And so the Mamluks are literally charging, you know, with takbirs and whatnot. And Napoleon tells his army, steady, 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 don't fire, don't do anything, until finally when they're in firing and visual distance, everybody fires simultaneously. The guns go off, the rifles go off, the cannons go off. And what do you think is going to happen, right? There is simply no comparison. The Mamluks with the skimtars and horses and Napoleon with trained battalions and with cannons. More than 6,000 Mamluk soldiers decimated. And Napoleon's losses were in the 100, at max maybe 200 French soldiers. More than 6,000 of the Mamluks completely gone. And this basically paved the way for the French to conquer the rest of Egypt. Quite literally, in the morning of that day, the Ottoman Mamluk leader, his name was Murad Bey, the Ottoman Mamluk leader left his palace with his pageantry, with his horses, with his, you know, army and whatnot. And that same evening, Napoleon slept in his bed. quite that same day. This is like the symbolic takeover. The same evening, Napoleon was in the palace of Murad Bey, surrounded by the luxury and whatnot of Murad Bey, and he had taken over literally in a few hours. The Battle of the Pyramids. The next few months, were set about, you know, consolidating his power over Egypt, and the West learned for the first time that it is super easy to invade, it is super easy to conquer, but it is impossible to actually rule. This was the historical precedent Napoleon set that nobody ever learned from up until our times, with the invasions of Iraq and Afghanistan and the invasions that will follow Allah knows when. Nobody learns from history. It is super easy to bring your gun, to bring your weapons, to bring your bombs, and to conquer. But once you've conquered, you cannot rule over a population that does not want you. Nonetheless, it was at this stage, with the conquest of Cairo, that Napoleon began to court the elites and the nobles and the ulama class. And he felt that if he could get the ulama class to be his allies, that the rest of the people would follow. So he made a very special effort with the ulama class, and especially with the Azhar scholars. And he told them that he was their liberator and ally. And he told them that he was not a Christian, and that he was an admirer of Islam. Now, the story of his conversion, quote unquote, right? Yes, it is mentioned in one or two early sources, but not of the first generation of actual eyewitness accounts. And technically speaking, it does appear that the conversion was a misunderstanding or an exaggeration of a later chronicler. He did, in fact, meet with the scholars of Al-Azhar. He did finance the Mawlid celebrations. By the way, interesting was that Bid'ah, I'm not even going to go there, right? Bonaparte financing the Mawlid. It's interesting here. The reason why he financed it was because there was no money that year because of the invasion. There was chaos. And Napoleon said, don't worry, I'll take care of the finances. So he sponsored the Mawlid. There was a massive Mawlid every single year. That year, Napoleon financed it. He gathered all of the ulama. And one of the senior scholars of Al-Azhar kept on, you know, pressuring him to convert, and told him, if you convert, we will be behind you. If you convert, the lands of Islam can be yours. Basically, he's using the Islam card and saying, look, because they didn't like the Mamluks for many reasons. They wanted another leader. It's human nature, by the way. I mean, politics is a dirty business. You're never going to appease the majority of people because it's just not possible to do that. But nonetheless, so a senior Sheikh of Al-Azhar was pressuring Napoleon. And in the course of that conversation, what appears to be the case is that Napoleon praised Islam immensely, and he praised the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, and he expressed his admiration of Islam. That's really what happened. Doesn't look like he actually converted. Yes, there are some books that say that, and yes, you'll find it in Muslim websites and whatnot, but I'm highly skeptical, and if you look at the original sources, they don't mention that. And in fact, we know, because we have clear statements from his own generals, from the people that are on the other side, where they're saying that Napoleon was basically using this as a ruse to court the ulama class, to praise Islam and whatnot. He was not a religious person per se, and true, he admired certain aspects of Islam, but he never practiced Islam. He never prayed or did anything that a Muslim would do. And there's no indication from the original sources that he actually uttered the Shahada. So the notion of his conversion seems to be a misunderstanding by maybe a second generation, third generation chronicler, where the extreme praise of Islam. Yes, he did praise Islam, and he praised the Prophet ﷺ, and he praised the Quran. And in fact, the next week he wrote a letter to a sheikh that was preserved. He wrote a letter to a sheikh in another city, and he said that, I hope that I shall be able to unite all of the ulama of all of the countries and establish a uniform regime based upon the principles of the Quran, which alone are true and which alone can lead men to happiness, end quote. Now again, nobody seriously thinks that he actually believed these words, right? His own chronicler, his own generals and whatnot, they're writing very factually, like, you know, Napoleon's making a fool out of these guys by flirting with their religion and making them feel that, you know, the religion is the best. And in reality, he does have some praise of the Quran and whatnot. He felt it to be more sensible than the Christian Bible. That doesn't mean he was a believer. And we should not embarrass ourselves by reading in more than the facts, you know, tell us. We have to be very careful and academic here. So to cut a long and complicated story short, the French attempted to rule over a completely alien land, foreign land to them. One whose culture they didn't understand, one whose language they had no, they didn't even speak fluent Arabic. It's just bizarre to imagine what's going on in 1798. You know, it's just a bunch of French people invading and then thinking they can rule over all of Egypt. But they tried. And for the next 2 years, they eked out an existence and they brought about lots of reforms and lots of changes. They introduced European customs, European notions. They introduced so many, you know, large and small things. The 150 scientists, by the way, they were given carte blanche authority to study and research, and they opened a scientific institute, or this institute for the study of science in Egypt here. And they did a lot of interesting things. Let me quote you Jabarti, our guy Al-Jabarti. Let me quote you some of Al-Jabarti's descriptions of what he himself saw. He's an eyewitness here. So I quote you from Al-Jabarti's book. The French installed in one of the houses a large library with several librarians who guarded the books and gave them to the readers who needed them. This library was open every day from 2 hours before midday. The readers gathered in the big hall besides the one where the books were kept. They sat in chairs ranged around the large tables and set to work. Even ordinary soldiers could come and work in the library. If a Muslim wished to come, he was not in any way prevented. On the contrary, he was welcomed in a friendly manner. The French were most pleased when a Muslim visitor appeared interested in the sciences. They immediately made themselves available to him, showing him all sorts of printed books with designs representing certain parts of the terrestrial globe, of animals and of plants. And then Jabarti says, I have had the occasion to visit this library several times and remain constantly astonished at the sight of all of these beautiful things. End quote. Al-Jabarti is impressed at a modern library. Wallahi, you cannot help but feel the reality of how things have changed. This is one of the key points. Muslims, I'm not going to say invented the concept of the library, that's a bit of a stretch, but there's no question 500 years before this point in time, there was no massive library in all of Europe. When there were libraries in Fatimid Egypt, when there were libraries in Baghdad, when there were libraries with 500,000 books in Andalus, right? Europeans had nothing like this. Now Al-Jabarti is impressed. His mouth, his jaw is dropping because he sees a modern library that is up and running and anybody can go and read books over there. Al-Jabarti writes about science, right? He talks about the astronomical instruments. He talks about the telescopes that could open and close, and they could be fitted into little boxes. And he says they were used to observe the stars and determine their distance, their volume, their conjunctions, and their opposite. And oh, the irony. Again, Al-Jabarti is impressed at telescopes and looking at the stars. And again, this shows you how things have changed from where to where, right? It was the Muslims who mapped out, who charted all of the stars, named most of them. It was the Muslims who invented the precursors to the very telescopes that the French are now using. And Al-Jabarti is in complete awe. Like, what am I seeing over here? He writes about biology as well. Of course, he doesn't name the discipline. And he says, and I quote, when an animal or fish unknown in France is discovered, they put it in a liquid which preserves it indefinitely without alteration. Again, you know, the preservation of samples. And of chemistry, he says that he visited one of their laboratories where one of the assistants took a flagon containing a certain liquid, poured a part of it into an empty glass, and lo and behold, it became a colored smoke. When the smoke disappeared, the liquid turned solid and remained a yellowish color. I touched this solid and I found it was hard as stone. The same experience was repeated with other liquids and they produced a blue stone, and a third produced a red stone like a ruby. And he goes on and on. Once again, he is impressed at chemistry and he doesn't even remember or realize that the term for chemistry, al-kimiya, came from the Arabs. And again, from where to where, subhanAllah. You really see the disparate worlds now of Europe and of the Muslim world. 1798, these two worlds are colliding together, and you see the one has superseded the other by light years. This is the reality. Now, of course, a lot of interesting things happened because the French were in England. The French were in Egypt for 2 years, right? So a lot of very interesting things happen over here. Small anecdotes are mentioned in so many different books. Al-Jabarti, for example, mentions that the French introduced the concept of restaurants, right? And he was bemused at the a la carte menu system, where you have the option of choosing a particular dish for a particular price. Because again, back in the day, the cook cooked whatever he wanted to cook, one meal, and everybody ate the same meal, and you paid, you know, or you bartered, you negotiated. It's a very different system, you know. So the notion of having a set menu, right, and then you choose, and then it's something he's intrigued by. One of the most predictable and yet awkward realities was the interaction between French men and the ladies of Cairo. That's a very sordid chapter, which again, much can be said, but it's not the time to get into there. But do realize that when you're going to have 20,000 soldiers and you have people in a very poor situation, starving literally, do realize that you're going to get the inevitable whenever any invading army comes. Whenever you have lots of men and then you have a population that's impoverished, you're going to get a lot of, you know, ladies of the night. And that business flourished in Cairo because of the soldiers, and lots of lurid and sad details of young ladies offering themselves for money, literally teenagers or younger. I mean, this is in their French chronicles, and you know, they're starving and then they're offering themselves, and they became well-known places. As you can understand, this is what happens anytime an invading force comes. As well, the elite of the French, those who could afford it, very soon picked up the habit of purchasing slaves and concubines, which was against all notions of the Enlightenment. In fact, it was illegal in France to do so. Technically, it was not allowed for them as French citizens to purchase slaves, much less concubines or whatnot. But hey, it's Egypt. Who's going to care? Who's going to do anything? And this shows you the clear, you know, double standards, if you like, right? And so the French would be very, the French noblemen, because again, it's money, it requires money, not the soldiers, but those who could afford to, they would regularly go to the slave markets, they would purchase young boys for their errands, and they would purchase girls for you know what. And you also had a very interesting phenomenon of French soldiers and French elite wanting to marry, you know, certain noble ladies of the Egyptian elite, for doing so for whatever reason, either because they're lonely or because they're going to establish ties or contact, or because, you know, human beings are human beings and romances are going to occur. And many of these ladies' families, they demanded that French convert to Islam. And perhaps the most famous was General Menou, M-E-N-O-U-E, General Menou. And General Menou was the person who was in charge. Napoleon left, as we're going to come to. General Menou took charge of the entire operation of the French being in Egypt. And he fell in love with a young teenager by the name of Zubaydah al-Bawwab. And he was so enamored with her, when her family said that he must convert, he actually converted to Islam. And he took on the name Abdullah. And he married Zubaydah. And when he returned to France, he brought Zubaydah with him. And he had a child with Zubaydah, whom he named Sulaiman. And I mean, as far as I know, they didn't really practice Islam many generations afterwards. But this particular General Menou is actually famous, and his name is inscribed to this day in the famous, you know, Arc de Triomphe, the famous arc of Paris. Everybody who's been there has seen it, right? His name is inscribed over there, and he actually converted to Islam. Al-Jabarti also remarks with a lot of sadness that a lot of the Muslim ladies who associated with the French, they began to dress like the French ladies. They discarded their veil and they started walking around, you know, displaying, as Al-Jabarti says, their zina to everybody. This caused a lot of anger in society as well. And again, realize that anytime you have lots of troops in a particular area, you're going to get the night ladies. You get my point. You're going to get rape, a'udhu billah. You're going to get not just that, prostitution. You're also going to get gambling. Oh yes, of course. Alcohol, right? How can you have a Western army invading without alcohol? And so alcohol became widely available. And of course, it's going to cause resentment and anger. The morality is changing, and people are, you know, things are happening that are riling up the population. And in 1798, finally, Sultan Salim III was roused into action. And he ordered a firman, a royal decree, in which he declared jihad against Napoleon. And a part of that firman read about the French, and I quote, "They mock all religions. They reject belief in another life, as well as its punishment and reward. They do not believe in the resurrection of the body, nor in the last day. And they think that there is a blind chance that presides over life and death, that they owe their existence to pure matter, and that after this life, their body returns to this earth, i.e. they're secularists, they're atheists, they're agnostics, they don't believe in a hereafter and God and whatnot. So the Farman of the Ottoman ruler, Selim III, is describing atheism and agnosticism because Muslims have never heard of this, right? Nobody, no civilization is secular until the French come along, and they are basically propagating these views. The Farman also reads, and I quote, "Their aim is to spread disunity amongst the rulers, trouble amongst the emperors, and incite the subjects to revolt." And then listen to this. "The French think that men, being born equal, must be equally free, that all distinction between men is unjust, and that each ought to be the master of his own opinion and of his own manner of living. They have the impudence to say, we are brothers and friends, the same interests unite us, and we have the same religious opinions," end quote. Now, it's very profound and interesting that modern notions of liberty were so alien to the peoples of Istanbul and other lands that all that the Farman had to do was to describe European liberalism and say, look at how ridiculous that is. Now, I'm not commenting on pro or con, I'm simply saying that the concepts of the Enlightenment were so foreign to the minds of the populations of that time that all Sultan Selim III had to do was describe, these are who the French are, how can you be like this? Very interesting, that's all I'm going to remark over here, right? Now obviously, with the decree of Sultan Selim III of Jihad, this now presented a crisis to the ulama and the religious clergy and the basically the loyalists in Cairo. Now, what are they going to do now? Now the Khalifa has declared jihad, and Sunni theology says you have to obey the Khalifa, especially when he calls for jihad. And so Sultan Selim III's Farman actually provoked one of the most famous attempts to overthrow Napoleon. And jihad was declared by thousands of local Cairo residents, and it was led by a group of ulama from Al-Azhar University. And the senior clerics of Al-Azhar were involved, and many of the students of Al-Azhar were involved. And in October of 1798, thousands upon thousands of Al-Azhar students and local Cairo residents, they banded together and they declared jihad against Napoleon. And they armed themselves with makeshift weapons, with household items, you know, literally sometimes even pots and pans. Well, not pots and pans, you get my point. Things in the household, right? And there was a respected Sheikh of Al-Azhar who was their main leader, and all of the deputies and all of the military commanders were basically, most of them were from Al-Azhar. And so this became the Al-Azhar resistance. And interestingly enough, Al-Azhar's campus and its famous masjid became the base of the resistance. Now, unfortunately, you know, as with most such rebellions, there's a lot of good spirit, but not a lot of planning. There was no one strong unified leader, no concrete plan of action, no thinking through two or three steps. And in reality, this is standard for all such movements, you know, good or bad. Just look at the Mutiny of India, which definitely deserves a library chat, the Mutiny of India. Just look at the Mutiny of India. Look at any other, without getting specific, think of any other attack or whatnot. Nobody thinks two steps ahead. Nobody's thinking things through. And so the same goes over here, that thousands of people come together, but unfortunately they had a mob mentality. They themselves wreaked a lot of havoc, killing innocent people, burning down people's residences, whatnot, that were not really guilty. Unfortunately, sometimes even, you know, women issue comes, because again, we have a bunch of men doing things. I mean, obviously there's no excuse, but things are going to happen. So obviously, you know, along that, you're going to get the very population you're trying to protect also gets frustrated at you. It lasted less than a week. Napoleon himself led the charge against the seminary students and their teachers. And of course, eventually, you know, Napoleon brought in the troops and the cannons. The French literally dragged in the cannons in the narrow streets of Cairo and aimed it at Al-Azhar University. Wallah, it's surreal. It is surreal. Al-Azhar University becomes the bastion of resistance. Pause here, footnote, what happened to Al-Azhar anyway, let's not go there. There were many good ulama. There are many good ulama as well, but things have changed very clearly, and wallahu al-musta'an. In any case, The cannons were pointed, the troops were sent in, and a massacre ensued. Over 3,000 ulama and students and locals were massacred. Buildings collapsed, the complete mayhem of the insurrection. Hundreds were taken prisoner of war, and many hundreds were executed and their heads put on stakes, because that's what that's what's going to happen when you have a rebellion. Al-Jabarti, who was an eyewitness, Al-Jabarti remarks sadly that the French soldiers entered the masjid with their horses. They urinated inside the masjid to desecrate it. They tore up copies of the Quran. They anybody who was, because the mosque became the center of the rebellion, right? So anybody whom they found in the mosque, they beat and they stripped naked so that he had to be humiliated and whatnot. And that's if they didn't capture and kill him, because all of the senior leaders, or many of them were, not all, many of them were executed. According to Al-Jabarti, many ancient relics and ancient books were destroyed. It is said that some of these books ended up in Europe, and Allah knows best. It is said. But in any case, the rest of the sheikhs of Al-Azhar were forced to surrender, and the senior most leaders were executed. And the second tier, Napoleon had them repent, gave them a forced oath of allegiance, or forced them to give the oath of allegiance. And he didn't want to alienate the rest of the population. He also spared Al-Azhar University, because there was talks of demolishing. There was talks of literally leveling it to the ground by the cannons. But he felt that that would not be a wise thing to do. Interestingly, Al-Jabarti mentions there were three factions of ulama. You had the first faction, who were leading the charge. They were waging jihad against Napoleon. And of course, you know, all of them either were killed or had to be forced to sign and whatnot. Al-Jabarti says there was a second group who were quietists. They didn't take sides. They didn't support Napoleon, but they also didn't support the insurrection, thinking that it would fail. And so they simply did not participate. And then he said there was a small third group that supported Napoleon and allied themselves with Napoleon. And their leader, of course, we already mentioned his name at the beginning, was Sayyid Khalil Bakri. This was the leader. He was al-Sheikh of al-Azhar, and he was Napoleon's main liaison, main right-hand man when it came to dealing with Muslim affairs. And interestingly enough, even the Christian chronicler of the time, he documents that this Sheikh al-Bakri, he was highly respected by Napoleon and the French, but he was despised by the Muslims because his loyalties were with the French and not with his co-religionists. Even a Christian chronicler points out that this Sheikh was despised by the other Muslims because he was viewed as a traitor. In any case, I'm going to finish off the next year and a half in 2 minutes. In the next year, a number of key battles were fought in the Sinai Peninsula and in Syria. The Ottomans really did try hard, and perhaps they were close to succeeding. But in the end, Napoleon managed to delay the main assault, and was, if not victorious, at least repelled the attacks of the Ottomans. And he returned to Cairo with great fanfare. A pompous ceremony was held in July of 1799. So we're fast forwarding a full year. Napoleon came back a victor. However, there were too many problems happening. Low troop morale, lots of troops dying from diseases. The plague, there was a huge outburst of plague during this time frame. The locals as well were constantly killing the soldiers. Attrition, there are stories of things falling from the sky, from houses and whatnot, and killing the soldiers anonymously. It is even said women were used to lure men, soldiers, and then kill them and leave them in the streets. So there was a very thriving underground resistance going on for this entire duration. And the main point is that the troop morale was going lower and lower and lower. And therefore, literally, in August of 1799, Napoleon decided to simply abandon his cause himself and leave somebody in charge. Without telling his troops, the troops woke up and they heard the news that Napoleon had left. And so Napoleon returned quietly to France, and he announced he had been victorious, and the people in France believed him, that we have a successful colony in Egypt. And so obviously this jettisoned his own career, and of course the rest is history in Napoleon's trajectory. That's a whole different category. He never came back to Egypt after that, from August 1799. And Napoleon left in charge his right-hand man. Within a few months, his right-hand man was assassinated in the streets. Another person, the one I told you about, Manu, he came in charge and he converted to Islam, at least outwardly and whatnot. But it was obvious that this was a lost cause. And the camel, the straw that broke the camel's back was actually the introduction of the British. The British got tired of this French play going on in Egypt, and the British sent their naval force, and they decimated completely, or almost completely, the French naval forces. And so for the rest of the 1800s, throughout the turn of the century, the French and the British are having a proxy war in Egypt, and eventually the French realize they're simply not going to win. And so in 1801, the French forces negotiate a treaty of surrender with the British, not with the Egyptians, with the British, and then they slink away. So from 1798 to 1801, 1798 to 1801 is the French expedition to Egypt. Napoleon is there for a little bit less than half of that time frame. Jayid. Okay. What are some of the main lessons that we learn from this really interesting episode? Well, Napoleon's invasion of Egypt was the first of many dozens of invasions. And the famous Edward Said, one of the greatest minds of the last generation, Edward Said remarks that Napoleon's invasion is the original sin in the nexus of Western quest for hegemonic power and knowledge. What Napoleon did was that he ushered in the era of colonization. He demonstrated Europe's insatiable appetite to control the world. He showed that Europe had this arrogance, the sheer assumed arrogance that it is divinely ordained to rule the rest of the world, and that it's qualified to do so, and that it will succeed when it actually does so. And of course, all of these presumptions are false. Another interesting point is that, of course, this invasion launched Napoleon's career, even though the occupation was in many ways a failure, right? Yet still, Napoleon came back to France and he was lauded as a victor. And this is, of course, a subtle form of racism. It's like you hate the other so much that any invasion is automatically considered to be a victory. One of the things as well that was sparked was knowledge was impacted. The French government and this Institute of Scientific Development that was founded by Napoleon, it commissioned a series of publications describing Egypt in a lot of detail. These books are still around, and these are amazing books written by, again, these are scientists and thinkers and historians. And you find these books, you still have these books in French libraries, and I think a few of them are in American libraries as well. These massive books that are talking about Egypt and the people of Egypt, diagrams, very beautiful diagrams, the first pictures ever, not photography, but, you know, diagrams carefully carved of what they discovered. The Rosetta Stone is discovered, by the way. The Rosetta Stone, hieroglyphics and translating hieroglyphics, is discovered by this team of scientists. And a lot of interest is generated. Egyptology is basically formed by these group of scientists, right? The study of Egypt. Also, Orientalism, the study of Islam, I'm not going to say it was invented by them, but it reaches a new level with these thinkers, and they're writing about Islam and they're talking about the Muslim world. Another thing that this invasion demonstrated, as we mentioned already, is the disparity of technologies, is the wide gulf of knowledge, of all types of knowledge, between the East and the West, of warfare and of the sciences, and of anything really. The West really has, by the 1790s, it's very clear which of the two civilizations is superior in terms of technological achievements and in terms of scientific developments. And again, there's no better demonstration of this than the actual battles taking place. On the one side, you have scimitars and swords and ancient muskets, and on the other side, superior cannons and weaponry and training. There is simply no comparison. Also, one of the most important points of this invasion is the printing press, and I've already mentioned the ironies of its introduction. And by the way, because of this, it's no surprise that Egypt in particular became the center of Muslim printing and of Arab printing, and especially in the Bulaq region, where the Bulaq printing press became the first or the most famous of the earliest printing presses. Also, one of the things that we see in this invasion is the Muslim land becomes a proxy for greater superpowers to battle it out. It is so ironic that this would not be the last time that two superpowers are fighting in Muslim lands using Muslim resources and killing Muslims as a part of their battles. The French and the British had it out in Egypt, and 200 years later, America and Russia would have it out in Afghanistan and in so many other places. You know, superpowers don't get involved in other countries out of a sense of goodness. No, you know, they want their share of the pie. And the British got involved because they hated the French. But as soon as the French left, the British now had direct control over Egyptian authorities. And in a few decades after this, the British literally ruled over Egypt until the 1950s and the Suez Canal incident. You can read your history over there. One of the repercussions of this invasion as well was that Napoleon's invasion of Egypt, ironically, actually launched Egypt from becoming one of the most backward and socioeconomically deprived lands of the Muslim world to, relatively speaking, becoming one of the intellectual and cultural capitals of the Arab and Muslim world, the center of attention, so much so that a past U.S. president intentionally chose Cairo to make an address when he wanted to show that he's building bridges with the Muslim world. The effects of this invasion directly catapulted Egypt to its current status of being a center of Arab and Islamic civilization. And again, this all happened as a result of Napoleon's invasion. Why? And again, that's a whole different history, but that is because the Ottomans sent a brilliant Albanian general by the name of Muhammad Ali Basha, who initially was sent to kick the French out, but the French already left anyway. He did help a little bit in this regard. But when Muhammad Ali Pasha came to Egypt, he decided to take charge of his own. And he seized control of Egypt from the Mamluks, and he famously invited all of the Mamluks to a massive feast in his own palace. Over 500 Mamluks were killed in that palace, in that infamous dinner that he held. And you can go and visit the actual palace and the actual streets. It's called the Street of Blood because it was flowing with all the Mamluk blood. Muhammad Ali Basha literally wiped out the Mamluk dynasty in one dinner. And then he declared himself the ruler of Egypt, and he even had ambitions to become the Sultan or the Khalifa of the Muslim world. But he began a series of modernizations, sending people to study in France because of Napoleon, and some of the great minds like Al-Tahtawi and others, the very first Sheikh and Alim to go and study abroad and bring back ideas and whatnot. All of this is coming because of Muhammad Ali Basha and understanding that the French are superior to the Arab world in technological matters. And of course, Muhammad Ali Basha established the dynasty that lasted in Egypt all the way up until King Farouk and his overthrow. King Farouk is a direct descendant of Muhammad Ali Basha, and King Farouk is overthrown in 1952 by Gamal Abdel Nasser. And of course, Egypt has been under military dictatorship ever since, except for that brief interlude after the Arab Spring. Another point of interest for us as well is the introduction of ideas that were alien to Arab and Muslim minds, right? Jabarti is mocking the introduction of a la carte menus, but in reality, a la carte menus didn't radically change the structure of the Middle East. What did change the structure of the Middle East is Western concepts of liberty, Western concepts of rights, Western concepts of nation states. And again, I'm not commenting good or bad. I'm simply saying that is exactly what happened. These notions are now being introduced for the very first time. And of course, we have the change of the morality, the change of the vices now being publicly done, and the hijab and whatnot. All of this is now changing for the very first time. These types of changes are happening at a societal level. Another very interesting point for me in this particular incident is to see the realities of ulama vis-a-vis tyranny. And you always have a spectrum. You always do. It's never nothing new. Jabarti categorizes three. I have actually done in a Facebook post last year, I did a more detailed, like I did a five type topography. But in reality, it's the same concept, right? You have those that are opposed vehemently, so much so they're willing to fight. And these were the people who declared jihad on Napoleon. And then you have the middle category who were quietists, who decided they don't want to get involved and they're just going to go about their stuff. And then you had the people who tried to validate Napoleon. And it's really interesting that that category is universally despised. Me personally, I excuse all the rest of the categories, and I say that all of them, it's not really, I don't see a problem. Each one has to decide where they want to go. And it's, you know, there were ulama who decided to work with Napoleon, but not for Napoleon. Big difference. There were senior ulama of Al-Azhar. They decided, you know what, there's nothing we can do. We don't want to get killed, all of us here. So we'll work with him, but not for him. And the small group, and Sheikh Bakri was the main one of them, he decided that he's going to work for Napoleon, to legitimize Napoleon and to rat out his own people, and he lost the respect of all people. And that's something that we find to this day. All tyrannical regimes, we have their equivalents to this day of their rubber stamping ulama, and they lost all of their izzah. And the main point here for us, and with this I conclude inshallah ta'ala, the most importantly, the French invasion, it whetted European greed. And it incentivized other superpowers attempting to leapfrog each other to see who could eat the largest share of the prize. It ushered in the era of colonization, Muslim lands being colonized. And Britain, of course, was the most nefarious with India and with strips of the Arabian Peninsula, and then with Egypt, and then with Sudan in the late 1800s. France then invaded Algeria in 1830s, and then Morocco. The Dutch and then the Portuguese were competing with Malaysia and the Far East. Libya was taken as a toy by the Italians, you know, Umar al-Mukhtar and others, you know. And so less than 100 years after Napoleon declared his Islam, or I should say his support of Muslims, because that's really what it was. Less than 100 years after Napoleon spoke with the ulama of Al-Azhar, less than 100 years after that, the bulk of the Muslim world was under direct colonial rule. And those that were not were under proxy rule. There was direct contact. And then, of course, World War I, and that was the straw that broke the camel's back. That's a deep pun over there, because the camel here represents the Ottoman Empire, the Muslim world. The straw that broke the camel's back is World War I. The sick man of Europe's janazah was prayed in 1922, if you like, metaphorically. And the Muslim world was then divided up into all of the nation states via the Sykes-Picot Agreement, barely a century and a decade after Napoleon and France. Subhanallah, right? And all of this was predicted by our Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam in a hadith in Muslim Imam Ahmad, when he said, "Yushiku an tatada'a alaykum al-umamu." It is only a matter of time before the other nations are going to be inviting one another to come and feast at your table, meaning your ummah, just like hungry people are called to eat at a common plate of food. The Prophet ﷺ predicted this, that is going to happen. And the Sahaba said, "Are we going to be very few in number, Ya Rasulullah?" And he said, "No, but you're going to be like, you know, the foam of the ocean, the flotsam and jetsam of the ocean. Lots of things in the ocean, but, you know, nothing of benefit over here." And that is because you won't have that iman. You're going to, you know, not be looking forward to meeting Allah Azza wa Jal. You're going to have weak faith. You're not looking, preparing for death. This hadith predicts quite literally the colonization of the Muslim lands. And in our case, for this particular incident, Napoleon's invasion is a watershed moment in our history, and it is the one single event that ushers in the modern era. It thrusts us directly, without even us wanting to do so, it thrusts us into modernity. And with Napoleon's invasion, the modern era of the Muslim world begins. It is something that, this incident is something that every single serious researcher and student of knowledge should study and be aware of. And with that, inshallah ta'ala, we finish today's chat, and I'll continue whenever the next time arises. And I hope inshallah we get electricity back full time. Jazakumullah khair. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuhu.
يا من أجبت دعاء نوح فانتصر وحملته في فلكك المشحون يا من أحال النار حول خليله روحا وريحانا بقولك كون